Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings. Welcome to the House of the Morris Tank. I'm your host, D. Miller L., a.k.a. Ashley Miller L. I have my co-host with me. Brother Free, you on deck? All right. We'll give them a few minutes to arrive. We have a very special episode for all of you listeners. Please share the link. Let anybody that you think will be interested know. We have two special guests this evening. First up, we have James D'Angelo. And on the second half of the show, we will be visited by Reggie Middleton. First guest that we have on the line is someone very, very special with regards to my learning of Bitcoin. I think it's been about 3 years now. And, you know, coming upon this information, it was definitely a mouthful, and it took a lot of time to digest and even comprehend. But to individuals like James D'Angelo, who had a YouTube channel at the time and was making the information digestible, I have to just give a shout-out to James on that level. But interestingly enough, coming back from the MIT Bitcoin Expo in Cambridge, James happened to be one of the speakers, the second presenter. And I have to say, it was definitely a shocking, or shall I say, a phenomenal presentation. Definitely the room was astir after James presented, and I think that we can expect the same thing this evening. Let me go on ahead and open up the line. Caller ending 8968.
Yeah.
James, how's it going?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How about you?
Good, good. How's Very Phoenix? Good.
Wow. Hot. I'm sweating. It's hot. It's hot. I'm so glad to be back on the West Coast after having been out there. It's been many, many years since I was even on the East Coast.
Yeah. I can understand that, you know. Got a few brothers living out there. They don't like to come back over this direction.
I'm sure. Let me see if my co-host is on the line. Free, are you there with us?
Yes, sir.
All
greetings.
So, James, you didn't get to meet my partner.
I'm in transit. I'm in transit right now, so I would just want you guys to take over for like the first 15 minutes, and then I'll be able to jump in, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. James, I got a couple of different things. First, I should say that, you know, for the listeners that are interested in the podcast or the YouTube channel that I'm describing, you'll want to go onto YouTube, type in WBN, that's for World Bitcoin Network, and you will be able to find a lot of the content that I'm describing, plus a plethora of other subjects that are discussed. And I think that, again, the listeners will definitely gain a lot from that. All right, James. So why don't we start with this, just so that we can kind of get some texture and a little bit of background on you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, education-wise, work-wise? You know, what do you do?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a goofball. I don't think that I actually have a degree from any of the universities I attended, but I was doing work at MIT for NASA and worked for Alan Lazarus, who died about a year and a half ago now, as my advisor, and Tony Mavredic at Boston University. And I was building hardware, so this is back in the day, 1990. At the time I was building hardware, I was also at home building other types of hardware. So I ended up building some samplers that kind of launched me into the music business. And so I still make most of my money doing music. But my big thing these days is I do a lot of research on Congress, and I really enjoy the Bitcoin stuff as well. So I see Bitcoin as solving a lot of really tough and thorny problems that are traditionally hard in large institutions, be it government or in the private sector, or just problems that have always been impossible to solve, like identity in developing countries, et cetera.
Okay. Is actually, I saw an interview, I forget, I think it was Epicenter. But I saw an interview. And you were talking about the music thing. So did I mishear that you're a hip-hop head, that you make hip-hop music, that you were...
Yeah, that's how I got started. So, you know, it's like if you can imagine what 1989 feels like, a lot of people can't because they weren't born then. If you had a sampler, it was like being the only guy with a baseball bat at the park, you know. You knew you were going to play. So, you know, you could basically pick your position. If you wanted third base, it was yours. So I had a sampler. I moved down to Philly. I lied to everyone, told them I was this big music producer. And, man, people needed beats back then. So people were trying to jump through the window. And, you know, just produced away. And just as crazy as it is because of the time, 6 months later, we're signed to Sony. 7 months later, I'm traveling around the world in a rap band. So I was like, wow, that was fast.
Right. Out of curiosity, would we happen to know, were there any big names that you might have produced for?
No, I didn't produce for anybody too big. The good news is our live band really ended up doing pretty well. So we played with a lot of big names. So, I mean, I actually sat in a room with, I don't know, I've done, the last show I did was with The Cure. But I've done shows with Beastie Boys, Del the Funky Homo Sapien, so many bands. I can't even remember all the bands. I mean, it's just like hundreds because we were just in that circuit, Cypress Hill. And so it was great. You know, we were on the same label as really big artists. So on our label, there were only five artists, and one was Cypress, then another was Criss Cross. Then another was the Fugees, and I think there might have been one other. So it was a cool little label.
It sounds like it. A lot of those are, you know, those are like major markers in my growth. You know, just as a person, because music, I'm super deep into music. I love music, all kinds of music, but R&B, hip hop, you know, that sort of thing definitely. I'll just have to make it plain, it raised me. It kind of gave me the mentality that I have. You know, I hear a lot of people talking about it today, a lot of the big wigs in corporate America. They're kind of describing the nature of hip-hop and how it kind of inspires entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And I definitely agree with that.
Well, it's certainly, you know, it's an open door where no individual can just say no, right? If you've got a really good album, no one's going to be able to keep it down. And so it'll explode past any sort of race barriers or barriers of prejudice or anything, right? So a great album just jumps. And at that time, people were so hungry for hip-hop that it really did. It just exploded a lot of people onto the scene who probably would have had a hard time trying to do anything else.
Right.
So it really was, and still is. I mean, it still makes a phenomenal amount of money for a phenomenal amount of people.
Right.
And you know, that's great.
You know, it almost reminds me a little bit, and this may be a little bit extreme, but I kind of take the position, you know, seeing as we deal with Bitcoin and blockchain, you know, the engine and the fuel. It seems like, especially in corporate America, there aren't too many items that aren't sold, you know, fueled by hip hop, i.e., you know, you hear the jingles, see the dress code, you see the attitudes associated with some of these people that are trying to pitch you, you know, goods and services.
Right.
So it's an interesting thing going on there. You know, before we actually step off of
beautiful.
The hip hop.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it's beautiful also in the sense that, like, you know, Marvin Gaye, who I think tried to do a really, really powerful album and is very inspirational music for me, especially like What's Going On. The style that he delivered in just didn't allow him to do the same thing that someone like Nas could do because he could put so many more words in, you know?
Exactly.
And so it was revolutionary in that sense, too. It was a form of publishing your book almost, you know, without having to wait for anybody to put it on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really beautiful. And you see, like, Nas blew my mind. I mean, just absolutely blew my mind. I'm like, there's just a genius there, right? And, you know, and those sorts of things are great because it's just like, who could deny the skill there? Nobody on earth, right? It's undeniable. And you can try and write like that all your life and you'll never make it. And so it's a real compliment to him, the race, whatever you can imagine. It was just undeniable. And I think that's great. And I think that's what Bitcoin offers, right? It offers a lot of people sort of a way to break into this new area without sort of the SEC and these traditional like walls and barriers to entry.
Right.
So I've always enjoyed those kind of things. And strangely, I feel some of the similar energy, right? You know, it's like,
mm-hmm.
This is exciting. This
well,
is changing the world.
Well, that's what you brought. That's what you brought to the conference. You went in there and, you went in there and, like, rained on everybody's parade as if, you know.
I hope not.
I really hope not.
I really hope not.
The tension was so thick. There was a couple
yeah,
of comments. I kind of remember them because I was watching you. You know, you were doing it. I was watching you. I don't know how, you know, reflectables there you were on the whole situation. However, I saw that you were mindfully doing what you were doing. But at the same time, like, I can tell you're a quick wit. And many of them that were there, I don't know if they necessarily caught on. Now, that may be the edginess of, we'll say, the mentality that exists on the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast. But
yeah.
I had a great time watching it. It was the comment. And, you know, I was even watching the stream after the fact, and it didn't pick up everything. It didn't do it justice. But I remember it was a female that was asking you a question, and you misheard her name. I didn't hear her name either, but you did the best that you could.
Yeah, I thought she was Giselle, and someone pointed out later. I feel bad about. But usually, if you, like, I remember I said, like, she said her name, and I said, Giselle. You know, and usually what someone will say is, no, that's not my name, right?
Right.
But she didn't. So I just rolled with her, right? She was in the back of the room talking soft. I didn't want to be rude. So,
absolutely. Absolutely. And then the second comment. And then the second comment was in relation to the mining, and we'll definitely probably get into this as I get to the meat of this interview. You were making a certain comment about the nature of mining.
Chinese.
That's right. And there was a bunch of Chinese there.
Yeah.
So I immediately was like just picking up like, oh, wow, this is getting more interesting by the second, because you didn't hold any punches. You were just like, hey, we have a problem. Right. Now tell me
what
it is that I'm saying is not the case.
Well, the funny thing about both of that is, especially as someone who was involved in hip hop and I was very concerned about civil rights, and a lot of our album dealt with Native American rights. I'm very interested in rights. That's my big deal. And to sit in a room with 240 guys and 12 women, or whatever the numbers were, and to ignore it, you know, I don't think is very cool. Right?
Right.
So we're obviously building a technology that has barriers to entry for females. And, you know, a lot of people might have been upset when I said, oh, you shouldn't be here as a joke, right? So maybe they didn't get the joke or whatever. But I turned around and was like, no, thank you. You're the person we need here, right? This is way off balance, this room, right?
Absolutely.
It should be 51% female. And instead we're about 3% female. And someone even wrote in and was like, well, the presenters, there were a lot of females, and I counted them, right? It was still about 20% female. So, you know, it's like we look at the Academy Awards and we can all run around and ignore this stuff, or we could talk about it. And I'm just the kind of guy who's like, hey, there's a problem. Let's talk about it, right?
Good deal.
So, and I don't know if you had planned stuff for later, but even with respect to the Chinese, I was like, Do you know that a lot of Americans think you guys are stupid? And that's the stupidest thing, right? The mistake the Americans are making is
right.
assuming. So, you know, it's like when I see the analysis that goes on, they don't respect the fact that people over there are really bright and know how to do phenomenal high-level business. And that particular guy, the miner there, followed me around the whole night because he knew that I knew that he was up to something. And what's amazing about it is in Bitcoin, it's not illegal. So if you are a miner and you are colluding with the chip foundry, there's nothing illegal about that. I wasn't accusing anybody of doing anything illegal because we don't have any regulatory stance against that, right?
That's
true. It probably would be deemed uncolorful, but if I'm over in China and I'm mining and two doors down is a chip foundry and I'm friends with them, you better believe I'm going to learn how to print money by making a friendship over there. So, and we don't know if they're Chinese. And I said that in my talk as well. We don't know if they're Chinese. A, because they're all anonymous. But they're probably there in China. They're probably Chinese, and they're probably remarkably bright, and they're making a ton of cash off of a bunch of ignorant Americans. So, yeah, you know,
I see.
Whatever.
I see what you're saying. I found it, like I said, it was definitely, seeing as it was my first Bitcoin conference expo, it was definitely a welcome that was, how should I say, it makes me want to get more engaged. It was very compelling. It made me realize that, you know, I do, we'll say, belong in this space.
You know what was funny with you? As soon as I heard your voice, I was like, oh, that guy should be working in radio. As soon as you asked me, I was like, oh, my God, that guy should be working in radio. Give me a break.
I mean, getting that since I was
voice.
Like in ninth grade. Yeah. So,
and then you tell me you turn radio. I'm like, well, that makes sense. God gives you a talent. You might as well use it.
I got to do it. You know, I've been hearing it all my life for the most part, ever since my voice dropped. So it's just like, okay, one plus one equals.
I'm still waiting for mine to drop. So,
so okay, let's do it, James. We're going to get to the meat of this. And I have a couple of concepts that I'd like for you to weave together and kind of present. First thing that I want to mention and reference is a video that you've done on YouTube called The Devil in Democracy.
Yeah. Awesome.
Mm-hmm. So I want you to reference that along with what you see as the problem with Bitcoin, because I think that there's a relationship between those two.
It's amazing how related they are, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's amazing.
So if you wouldn't mind breaking them both down, and then maybe even how they go together, if you can kind of even take us step by step on how we can relate one to the other, because I think that it's obviously it's layered.
Yeah. It's phenomenal. I'm good. That's great. You promised to bring it hard, and you are. That's great. I'm halfway through a beer. I'm like, God, I should be quarter of a way right now. But you know, it trips me out endlessly that Satoshi puts the word vote in his, right? So if you look at the Bitcoin community, the last thing you want to hear is vote, because vote only means one thing. It means democracy. And what does democracy really mean? And I think even the United States is struggling with that concept. And I don't think we've ever, since the Greeks stumbled upon it, we've ever really inspected it and figured it out very well. But one thing that's clear is that democracy might be the only method that humanity has ever come across that fights power.
Okay.
So if you have power and you don't have democracy, you have a king. Or you have some crazy, ridiculously powerful leader, or you have some ridiculously powerful militant group. So if you don't have democracy, then you have a king. Now, if you have democracy, you still might have problems, but I would say That's because your democracy has not been set up correctly. And the interesting thing is, in the United States in 1860, a very phenomenal thing happened. There was an election, and we elected this guy named Abraham Lincoln as the president. So we're all in the middle of the presidential fury now. You can imagine what it felt like back then. We're all like, wow, people are so hard left and hard right now. Imagine what it was like back then when Abraham Lincoln is coming in, and if
right.
he wins, most of the South right. is going to lose their way of doing business, i.e. slavery. And in particular, it's not most of the South, because only 1 to 4% of the real big businessmen were the big slaveholders. The rest of the state was basically like, I go out my back door, I farm my yard right, by myself. I can't afford a luxurious item like a slave. They're actually really expensive, $1,000, right? Mm-hmm. Which back then is a ton of cash for a lot of farmers ever in their life. But we have this election. So in 1816, so it's, you know, we're voting. But in 1860 in the United States, the vote isn't secret. So how does it work? There's this glass
right.
bowl in the town square, a glass bowl. And you walk in with a colored ballot and drop it in the glass bowl in front of the sheriff, the constable, and other election officials, all from your town, and in front of probably a few people with real power. And so even if you own no slaves whatsoever, you now have to go vote and drop your colored ballot, because it's going to be green for Lincoln and blue for, you know, in front of these people into a big glass bowl. And what amazing thing happened is, in the state of Georgia, we know exactly how many people voted. We know the count. We know how many people voted for Lincoln in 1860.
Right.
And the answer is zero. Not one person. You can never hold an election. You can't hold an election for anything and get zero unless everyone is scared. Right?
Agreed.
You want zero? You want zero votes? That's the guy in Russia running the vote for his Duma, right? They all vote, you know, exactly what he says. So whenever you have people voting inside a glass bowl, you have people who are getting really scared and people getting really intimidated. And so even though you have a democracy, you end up with this thing that still really helps out power because people are scared of how they vote. And so Lincoln didn't do very well in the South, though I would say if it was a secret ballot back then, he might have. It certainly doesn't seem clear that most of the Southerners hated Lincoln. It's just not clear that that's true at all. So where am I getting at? What's very interesting about this is voting has, if set up properly, so in 1869, 1890, they started doing the secret ballot in the U.S., and the weirdest thing happened. They started doing it for a lot of nefarious reasons, some pretty good reasons, but all the big, powerful, Gilded Age companies start kind of going out of business. All the people who've been rigging elections disappear. So by setting up the democracy better, we started to get a country that provided more equality to everyone. So around 1920, things really turned. This is ridiculous. Sorry. Things really turned, and people started to live a lot better, and they started to be more equal, and we started to pass really cool laws and all that stuff. So, again, democracy is a way of decentralizing power, and that's really key for Bitcoin.
How so?
The more people who have some stake in it that's an equal stake, the more you have something that's decentralized.
I.e. the vote.
So Satoshi does this in his white paper, and he says, vote. And he's sitting there, you know, he's back in 2008. He's like, well, everybody's got a computer. Very few people have 12 computers. What if everybody could vote with their computer? And he thought about this for a while, thought it was a great idea, and he released proof of work. And, of course, it worked pretty good. Because at that point, there were no ASICs, and there wasn't a lot of money in Bitcoin.
and it was a very decentralized network. Everybody was mining individually, so for the most part, you had a democracy. And everything was decentralized. My nephew's mining in California. My friend Anders is building his little mining rig in his home here in Boston. I'm mining off my laptop, right?
Uh-huh.
And then the first ASICs come out. And we should have realized then that that was a bigger problem. But everyone kind of thought, wow, that's changed something. But no one ever really figured out exactly what was changed. And an ASIC is basically vote buying, right? So you can buy all the votes you want. You go out and spend $300, and now you have the equivalent power of 500 individual miners mining off their CPUs.
Let me slow you down for a second, James. I want to understand a little more. What do you mean? How is it that, you know, because it almost seems like we're jumping from, okay, we have individuals on their laptops, on their PCs mining, and these individuals you're describing represent a vote. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And as time progresses from the CPU to the GPU to the ASIC chip, that you started to see something change. And what you're saying is changing is that the number of people that can engage in voting has now dropped. What is it that you're saying?
Exactly. And the only people that are engaging in voting are people who are putting money into the process. So no one has an ASIC because they just needed to compute SHAs, right? No one needed to do SHA-256 to run Photoshop or send an email. The only reason you were buying an ASIC was to get yourself more Bitcoin. And so you were rigging the system. Right, you were buying votes, and a lot of other people were too. So I would say at the beginning, because ASICs weren't super expensive, it kind of seemed like maybe that was okay. And a lot of people had ASIC miners. The trouble is, everything in the world can be made as a good, can be controlled better by the organization making it, and they can now, it's the economy of scale, right? If I'm buying directly from China and mining directly, I'm going to do much, much, much better than someone else who might not be getting that directly. So they might be paying KNC a fee to put the rig together for me. It has to be shipped.
Right.
By the time I get it, it might be old. There's no certification that the chip I got was the latest chip. It's possible it's 2 weeks old and people have taken advantage of the process. So you've introduced a situation where someone can corner the market, where you can get economies of scale, right? So, you know, even 20 years ago, I thought every burrito is made by the store, you know, the owner of the store, right? You go to a burrito place, it would always be Dave's burrito and Dave would be there. Well, now you have Chipotle, right? And it's the economy of scale. We don't need to pay an owner a life wage. We can now pay kids minimum wage. And we save a ton of cash, and we run this all as a business, and we do monster buys through big farms that sell us tons of tomatoes. And everything we do is cheaper than Dave can do individually.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with this economy of scale, be it bread making, car making, computer manufacturing, socks, whatever it is, it's easier to do at scale. And it is one of the biggest problems with free market economies in the world, which is why in every single developing country on earth, you have one set of specific laws, and they're called antitrust laws. We make laws against this. Because it always happens. Monopolies always form. It's just a naturally occurring process in life. And I didn't even mention this in the talk because I didn't have enough time, but every single developed country on earth, and many that aren't, has antitrust laws. You're not allowed to monopolize. Is that free market? No, it's not at all. you need to have a competitor or we will not let you do business. If Coca-Cola was the only soft drink manufacturer in the United States, they'd get sued and they'd have to divide into two separate entities to compete. But again, Bitcoin has stayed above all of this. And there is no measure of how much centralization of mining is going on. But there's just no question in the world by looking at the hash rate that it's happening. And it likely suggests a direct pipeline between miners and chip manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any way to measure it at all, and that we were playing real ball, they would be subject to antitrust legislation.
Understood. Let me ask this question before you go further, James. So I'm having a hard time with one thing in particular. So I believe it's one thing to mine. I want to make sure you agree. It's one thing to mine. It's another thing to be profitable at mining. Are those two separate things, or is it you can't have one without the other?
Well, I can mine. I can turn on my computer and mine right now. But I'm going to be mining at one mega hash or something ridiculous. So it's a bit like me tossing a drop of water on the ocean and go, wow, I'm making the world a wet place, right? I'm doing nothing, right? Just absolutely nothing, right? But, you know, the ocean's evaporating more per second than I'm contributing. I love when people get into argument about this on me. They're like, oh, if they start controlling things, I'll just turn my miners on. I'm like, your miners are off because they weren't profitable 2 years ago.
Right.
I mean, they sucked 2 years ago. You're going to turn them on now, and the only thing that's going to happen is you're going to get an electric bill. Right. You're not going to affect the hash rate at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what's happening.
So does that mean that they don't have a – does that mean that as a miner contributing the power to the process, does that – without receiving any sort of Bitcoin in return, does that mean that they don't have a vote? Does that mean that they're not –
You know, if you mined with your CPU for 20 years, you probably wouldn't affect the process even once at this point. So just keep in mind that – yes, by turning your miner on, you do affect the hash rate, right? Every processor that's on affects the hash rate. But the percentage of effect that you're making is so low that I can negate you in calculations, right? It's just ridiculous. You know, I don't even know what the numbers are, but one mega hash right now, I wouldn't even have to round off for my science class, because the number would be so far to the right of the decimal, or what is it, right of the decimal. So it just doesn't matter at all. And you mentioned 21 Bitcoin or whatever they are in your question, and we spoke about it a little bit by ourselves. And I've come up with more information since then, just from talking to people. And 21 is playing a crappy game, right? And
correct.
One is they're mining, and what I found out that evening is they're mining, and as I suspected, losing money on it. So they're basically running older chips because there's no way to run the modern chips because the modern chips go first to someone in China. You know, they might be Sicilian for all we know, but someone sitting right outside the door. And he's mining for a few months, and then they sell those to 21. And then 21 sells them to you. And by the time you're turning it on, all you're doing is heating up your room. And,
got it.
And so it just really it becomes on the level of buying a $1 mega ball ticket, right? You know, or $2, whatever it is. Yeah, you know, you might win someday, but let's not pretend that – you're really doing something here.
Right.
And so 21 is going to go out of business next year is my guess. And so will Bitfury, right? There's no way to play the game from the United States as the second person down on the tree. And what's even more interesting about this is if mining is centralized in China or centralizing, or it's a cabal or a small group of people, they know very well what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so if you run 80% of the mining and you have the modern chips, you know that everybody else is losing money. And so they're just stepping their foot on the gas until they've cornered the market. Price for them to control mining drops really low, but they're still making the 2 million or whatever it is a day that Bitcoin is handing them. We're handing them 2 million a day. 2 million a day, that's big even for big chip foundries. Right? So whatever it is, 400 times, what is it? You get 25 Bitcoins in a block, and there's 144 blocks. Do the math. It's a ton of cash that we're handing out a day. And there's just so many better things we could do with that money. Right? Wouldn't it be great if we were putting 2 million a day into lobbying or, you know, harassing governments or doing whatever? I mean, there's so many things that Bitcoin could do with it. So, yeah, I brought the dark cloud, but I'm also like, man, we're just giving it away. And we're giving it away to people who don't give a crap about
it. Listen, James, I appreciate, you know, the counter view, because so one thing that I'm sick of in terms of the Bitcoin ecosystem, you know, I've been around long enough now that, you know, all of the optimism without real logic is annoying.
Yeah.
And I think that it takes the contrarian view, which, you know, I kind of feel like, or I hope that, you know, as this year goes on, we can have more dialogues throughout the year. I want to kind of chase the tail a little bit further on this voting. And in the YouTube video that you have, where we were talking, the devil in democracy, there was this concept of proportional representation.
Mm-hmm. Which someone figured out 150 years ago, and you can't find a single major academic talking about it. And it's, I mean, it's a back of a napkin calculation. Like, it's not like maybe this is right. That is the most right. That's just like A plus B equals C. That is right. And
I don't want to speak over the listener's head. I think you and I are having a conversation, definitely. But break down a little bit what you mean by how, and especially, you know, one, how does it apply to democracy? And two, how would it or how could it apply to Bitcoin?
Well, those two are a little bit unrelated, because the problem with devil and democracy is you're breaking the country up into 50 separate states. And so you get 50 separate voting units. And that creates problems with how you arrange that and how you run the elections for that. Whereas Bitcoin doesn't do any of that. It doesn't break anything up. It's always the whole group voting all the time. And so when you're running your miner, you're trying to beat the hash to basically pull your ticket to win those Bitcoins. But by trying to win those Bitcoins, you're contributing to the protection of the network. And in essence, you're voting by verifying that that transaction was true.
Say that one more time.
So say you're running your miner. I don't care how many hashes per second you're doing. You're running it for, most people are running it for selfish reasons, right? You're running it in hopes that you're going to land the big ticket, which is you're going to produce the hash for that block.
Yes.
And that will give you 25 Bitcoins times $400, whatever that is. That should be easy. What is that, $10,000? Yeah, $10,000. Mm-hmm. So we're giving out $10,000 every 10 minutes, 144 times a day. So that, yeah, it's over $1 million a day that we're putting out. And so you're mining to try and win that, but at the same time, you're validating transactions. And if you misvalidated those transactions and you had the winning hash, you only get paid out a number of blocks later. And you only get paid out if you did the right thing according to the following blocks. So you have every incentive to do the right thing, to make sure your computer's hashing correctly. Because if it makes a mistake, the Bitcoin network will back up cough your block out and start with another block. And you'll get zero mining rewards. So when you're running your miner, you want to make sure your software is working and doing the right thing, because if you win the big ticket, you want to win the big ticket, right? And so that's how it keeps the network honest. So how do I make sure my computer is doing the right thing by this financial incentive that it has? But if I've got so much hashing power that I control over 50%, then it really doesn't matter what my computers do, right? I can make mistakes because I know I'm going to win the next block, and I'll just say that was correct, and then make mistakes again. I'll win the next block and say that was correct. And just like in a democracy, if you've got over 50% Republicans in the Senate, 50% over 50 in the House, and the president's a Republican, you kind of basically pass any legislation you guys can agree on, right? You don't even have to care about the minority. And so in the video with The Devil and Democracy, it has everything to do with that threshold, right? If you have a minority that's under 50%, which would be any minority, right? So if you're a lesbian, gay, you know, you're down at 5% or 2%. I don't know what you are. Maybe everybody in the world will out themselves tomorrow, so it'll be 100%. But right now you're at 2%. So you aren't respected by democracy in any pure form. Even if you're a large minority, like Latinos are up around 19% now, you're going to lose every piece of legislation every time, because the majority is significantly bigger than you are. And so there's some of that in the Devil and Democracy. Where minorities always get screwed because of how we vote for senators. If you're going to vote, really the secret sauce is, if you're going to vote for 100 senators, you don't break it up by time or state. You vote for all of them at once. And so the big rock star famous white guys, because there's so many white people in the U.S., will win a number of senators. But even if you're a 1% group, a group with only 1%, if you're organized, you're going to land a senator. A 1%. And keep in mind that in the Senate, it's all about margins, because you've got the right beating up the left. So if you've got two or three senators that can go either direction, they can control policy. Well, if blacks are voting together as a unit, that's 13 senators. 13 senators that can sit on the margins of every piece of legislation and go, you want to do this? You give me that. It's all about margins of democracy. And so if you have minority groups representing the Senate, it just explodes the whole way we do things. And it would work out much better, so much less corrupt. And all the founding fathers hated the way it worked out. They all wanted it to be much more representative of the people at large. So it was a compromise. And again, it was a compromise to the slave states. It was terrible. And it's a mathematical mistake, and why big academics don't talk about it. So they're all related. They're all a little bit different, too. But that's what I do. I study voting. I study democracies. And Bitcoin, whether it likes to call itself that or not, is. And it's got the same problem, because it breaks down right at 50%, just like the Senate, just like the House, and just like the Supreme Court, right? Right now, we have this really exciting Supreme Court, because we got 4-4. It's like, hey, that's exciting. Let's see them bang heads for the next 5 years, you know?
Right,
right. It's certainly a lot more interesting than 5-4, because 5-4, that group, the 5, always wins. So,
You know, again, I have to say, James, you know, you definitely came with the same fire. You definitely came with the same very strong position, and I feel like we have more to talk about, because, one, I definitely want to follow up on the prediction, Big Fury as well as 21 Co. We want to follow this up, and we want to even observe some of the haps throughout the year. And my thing is this. I think now I can kind of lay it out, but from my position, from what I see, first and foremost, I'm in agreement. the idea of who is processing the payments and maintaining the integrity of the blockchain, that's paramount, right?
Yeah.
And the idea that it's centralized really defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
Right?
Might as well just set PayPal.
Exactly. So I'm with you on that. However, I'm kind of under the impression that we're going to see more evolution of this mining thing. Like you said, there was a lack of comprehension of what was even going on in its early CPU days into the GPU days, let alone when the ASIC showed up, right? The ASIC showed up and everyone starts looking at their pocketbook like, can I get one? I want one.
Yeah.
Like you said, it was the incentive was there, right? Before I could even get into mining, the ASIC was there. I remember there was a guy that I had met very early on in my studies of the subject, and he had a little rig that he was putting together. But even at that time, he could not mine for Bitcoin. He had to mine for the alternative coins and then transfer trade those in on Cripsy or something like that, which is now what, defunct as well.
Right.
So I think that there's going to be a lot more evolution. I'm really under the impression that even though it may not look like it or it looks kind of weird right now, potential that, you know, this blockchain, this Bitcoin, this is going to be, you know, the internet come again, right? Or the improvement.
I
really think that's the case. And I think that, again, the way that the hardware, and I'm talking about all mobile devices that are internet-based or connected, I should say, they're gonna also, you know, as long as they come with, you know, the feature of being able to access Wi-Fi, they will also come with a certain number of chips, and some of these are going to be, you know, Bitcoin blockchain related, right?
Yeah,
I think that's a natural progression.
I do think if your main thing that you're trying to do, in Bitcoin's case, it's decentralized, the mining. I think if that is the main thing you're trying to do, you should do it, right? So there are ways to decentralize, none of which anybody wants to hear about. All involves voting in democracies, but that really does decentralize. And anything else, I would say cross your fingers.
All right. Well, James, I hate to have to cut it short in the middle. I feel like it's the middle of a conversation.
No, that was
hopefully
great. That was perfect.
Absolutely.
I'm gonna make myself some dinner, anyways.
All right, very good. We're still gonna be on. If you want to listen again, Reggie Middleton is gonna be joining us. I'm sure you're aware of him. I have some good questions for him, and I'll allow him to be introduced to our audience as well. So, James, I bid you well. I hope to have back on. We'll say in a month or two, we can revisit some of these subjects, and maybe I can lay out a little more of what I think. You can lay out more.
That was really fun.
Yeah, we could talk to the callers as well next time. All right, James, take care. I appreciate you.
Bye now.
All right. I'm going to pause for just a moment. And now I'd like to open it up for our second guest. We have the chief provocateur with us, Reggie Middleton. Reggie is going to be an excellent guest at the House of the Moorish King. I want for you all to actually take a seat and be prepared. You are definitely going to hear something that you may have never heard, and you're going to hear something that is actually amazing once you actually comprehend what it is that's being described to you. I think Reggie is going to be an excellent person to actually describe these things. You know, it's very technical. We're dealing with finance. But at the same time, I think that even a layman will be able to benefit from this interview that we're about to have. Please share the link with anyone that you think would be interested, family and friends. We are about to have our second guest, Reggie Middleton, on the line. I'll give you all just a moment to share.
Yo, did you open up my line, bro?
You're already on the line. I'm going to open up Reggie in just a second.
Oh, okay. All right, man. That was explosive, though.
It was definitely awesome. It was definitely awesome. Hey,
we got him?
Yeah, we do have Brother Reggie online. Reggie Middleton, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Greetings.
Greetings, brother. How are you?
Oh, all is well. All is well.
Oh,
how are
all
things
is well.
With you?
All is well. How are things with you?
I'm doing well. I'm actually at my son's high school. There's still background noise.
All right.
Okay.
Family man. Gotta take care of it.
Yeah, this is her teacher
night,
so. At Brooklyn Tech.
Oh, that's awesome. Free, I'm gonna let you I know you've been in transit. Are you in a place where you can actually begin to engage as well? Or would you like for me to
I've been waiting, but you know, we had to take time, so.
All right, good deal. So, Reggie, I'd like to begin this interview first and foremost with allowing our guests to get a little bit familiar with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, education, and what it is that you do?
I have a bachelor's degree from Howard University, business management. From then on, I spent about 9 months in corporate America. There was a mutual distaste for that, and I built that on my own afterwards in a variety of ventures. All small and entrepreneurial, financial advisory software. I had a .com during the .com craze. From that point, I went on to, I had 3 children, and I went on to invest in real estate starting in 2000, right in the area that I'm standing now, the downtown Brooklyn, Fort Greene area in New York. And I was able to catch the wave of gentrification as the demographics in this area of Brooklyn changed, as well as a credit bubble that made easy money. The combination of the two lit this area on fire, and that was my first $1 million made there. After about 5 years of doing that, did very well from a return perspective. I think I had roughly maybe 200% return on the initial investment. 2 + 2 started to equal 55. And, you know, I'm not a mathematician, but I do know 2 + 2 is not 55. So I decided to, and I wasn't a flipper. I actually started building a portfolio of brownstones and small income-producing properties. But, you know, once the math started, you know, becoming ridiculous, I decided to sell everything off. And I had the last building in contract 2006. The market started collapsing in 2007 in New York, so it was about 6 months early, which is basically fairly timely. Now, this has nothing to do with me being a genius or a soothsayer. You know, it's simple arithmetic. You know, 2 + 2, you know, does not equal 55. I then wanted to open a hedge fund and take advantage of the leverage that I saw all the hedge funds had during the boom. Basically, I wanted to short everybody who was in business with me. And for those who are not familiar with the vernacular, short means to bet against. So make a bet that a particular asset, stock, or company is going to go down in price versus up. And so I decided to open and start a hedge fund. The hedge fund didn't work out because hedge funds were in a bubble at the time as well. But I also, in addition to starting a hedge fund, wanted to market myself. I couldn't market the fund directly because that's against the law, SEC rules. So I wanted to market myself. This was necessary because I didn't have the stereotypical background of a typical hedge fund, you know, New York or Greenwich, Connecticut hedge fund guy. You know, I didn't come from Harvard Business School. I didn't serve, you know, several years in a Goldman Sachs process. You know, I looked sound and accurately from the other guy. So I created a blog and basically put my opinion out, you know, for everybody to consume for free. The blog became very popular, so popular that the demand for the advice, information, knowledge, some would say, was becoming laborious. So the best way to get somebody to leave you alone is to ask them for money. So I put a paywall up. Everything went silent. Got a couple of good nights' sleep. And then one day, Morgan Stanley called and said, if we wire you $10,000, would you turn on 3 of our prop traders? And I was proprietary strategy traders. I said, of course. So we would turn it down. And that was the birth of Boom Bust Blog, which was one of the first paid blogs that I could actually charge.
Right.
And we charged a decent amount. You know, we charged anywhere from $500 to $3,000 a year. for Rita. And that ran for 7 years. And during that period, I made a lot of interesting calls. You know, I called the calls. We had certain Lehman Brothers, 42 regional banks, of which I think about half of those failed. All of them, you know, went down in price by about 60% minimum. I called the European debt, sovereign debt crisis, Ireland, Rose, Portugal, Irish, Spain. I called the collapse of BlackBerry, which used to be Research in Motion. I called the battle between Microsoft, Apple, and Google. Google's ultimate ascendance versus Apple, et cetera, et cetera. So overall, roughly about 82 calls across a variety of industries and sectors, real estate, finance, technology, et cetera. During this time, roughly about 2012, a couple of my clients were asking me to give their opinion, my opinion on Bitcoin. And, you know, I was going through a lot of business and personal issues at the time. I just basically never got around to it. About a year and a half to 2 years later, I did succumb to the cacophony and decided to look up Bitcoin. And I read the Bitcoin Wiki and the Bitcoin white paper. And reading that, my jaw dropped. It literally hit the ground. I knew better than to go to the popular media because the popular media didn't necessarily report back. Basically, the popular media's job is to sell eyeballs and impressions, not necessarily.
I'm sorry, Reggie. We can't hear you. If you could pause and allow for that loud speaker to go by or what have you, then you can go ahead.
Okay. My apologies. Parent teacher night is over. That was the announcement. So, I didn't go to the mainstream media, primarily because the mainstream media does have a proclivity not to report facts, but they're simply still eyeballs. So I went straight to the source, which is the white paper for Bitcoin and the Bitcoin Wiki. And after reading it, my jaw hit the ground. I couldn't believe what I read. You know, a digital currency with its own programming language and its own transportation rails that allow for things such as smart contracts to be written, that are self-executing, can't be hacked, can't be breached. You know, these things were basically business and finance and technical nirvana. They literally didn't exist before 2009. And this was an actual invention. But because of the libertarian bent of the early users and participants, I think it wasn't taken seriously early on. I definitely took it seriously, and I decided to actually drop the whole advisory business to Bloomberg Blog and go 100% head first into a Bitcoin startup, which basically business was to create smart contracts to solve business problems and to disintermediate any entity that basically doesn't earn its keep. Disintermediation is a term where you basically take out the middleman. So let's say we have a broker, and that broker makes money by putting, you know, seller A with buyer B. Even though seller A and buyer B are sitting in the same room, the broker puts them together because the broker knows seller A's name and seller B's name. He puts them together, grabs a 5 or 6% commission off of it without really adding any significant value. Basically a gatekeeper. To disintermediate this broker, you would allow seller A to meet and transact with seller B directly. And in doing that, there's no need for the broker. They save that 6% fee, and they have less friction in the transaction because it's less moving parts. So basically, this software does that, but it does it for a wide variety of industries. And it does it by taking money, making it programmable, and then giving the ability to take a social or legal contract, program that contract, make a computer code, embed it into that money, or embed the money into the contract, vice versa, and have it executed on its own in the cloud without being able to be hacked. So these contracts are unbreakable, they're unbreachable. You don't have any risk to your counterparty, so it doesn't matter if the guy has money or not. He has to pay for the funds to put up front, and you don't have to worry about credit risk. You don't have to worry about them going bust, going bank, et cetera. Now, this is a sea change in the way things are done. We have 3 patent applications, and for the way we do business, these patent applications are monumental in my regard. My chief technology officer, who's a 15-year veteran in payments and programming and markets, is also an intellectual property patent attorney. With his help, and with the help of my analyst, my financial analyst, we went through about 230 patents dating back to 2008 and scoured through all of them. And we are quite confident in saying that we're the first to patent the capital markets application to this technology. We beat all the big Wall Street banks, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Goldman Sachs. We beat all the big tech companies, IBM, New York Stock Exchange, et cetera. Pretty good for, you know, a small startup in Brooklyn. In addition, we were first to have a prototype running. So since December 2013, we had a prototype that allowed you to trade roughly about 45,000 tickers directly with another entity, thereby disintermediating the Wall Street banks and brokers. This is a prototype. It's a demo, but it works 100%. You can download it right now. You can type in the ticker. You find another person to pay with. You have the Bitcoin. You can do it. This is one of many applications, and we're going to spread this technology to real estate, to insurance, of course, to finance, asset management, trading, healthcare. You know, the sky's the limit. So you see, we're thinking very, very big. This is what I call true disruption. Now, there are a lot of entities who are trying to take your technology, and they're trying to make the extant industry run better. For instance, they're trying to improve the back end of, you know, banks and the bank technology, which is good if it's successful and makes the banks run a little smoother. But that's not true disintermediation. That's not true disruptive. So you have a choice of you have a car industry, and you have a technology that can make cars run faster and more efficient. And then you have a small startup that has a technology that makes cars unnecessary. So think of, you know, tuning car engines and make them faster, or having a transporter from Star Trek that beams you from point A to point B. We're the guys building the transporter. And that's a quick beginning to end synopsis of what I've been doing over the last, 7, 8 years.
Interesting. Free you there.
Hello.
Okay. Reggie, free you there?
Yeah.
Okay, you got the floor.
All right, so we've heard how, you know, you can basically take Bitcoin technology and apply it to any other, you know, financial technology in existence. And I think it's a good contrast, as the previous, you know, guest we had on talked about a lot of the different issues that Bitcoin is having. So this one is good for, like, showing all the different applications that Bitcoin can achieve. You know what I mean? And one of the things I wanted to talk about with the guest previously was that we do need to decentralize as much as possible in order to really, you know, pull the power away from the central, you know, authorities and everything like that, because that is what is destroying commerce in a lot of different sectors. And like Reggie Middleton has said, you know, they're not willing to get with the paradigm shift. You know what I mean? It's a major paradigm shift going on right now. And we have to really take advantage of it. And if, you know, that's what we're about here at the Moabit Association, is definitely decentralizing, you know, trying to have ledger systems that don't have any fraud on them. You know, at the end of the day, it's about anti-fraud and about decentralization. We even made up a slogan called Decentralize or Die. That's how important this is. So, Reggie, I would ask you, what do you think about decentralization as, like, the world needs to embrace that idea to move away from the centralized way of thinking that has created so many problems in the economy?
Well, centralization is something that, you know, it's a technical term, but in reality, it's also an economic concept as well. And centralization is something that happens naturally as power congregates towards the more powerful. Now, those who are in power want centralization because, you know, it makes them more powerful. Those who don't have the power should, you know, they often don't, they should shy away from centralization. That doesn't make centralization bad per se, because oftentimes when you have centralization, you have increased efficiency. Along with the increased efficiency, you also have significantly increased socioeconomic disparity. Basically, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Okay, our platform goes way beyond decentralization. You know, we're fully distributed. So to give you a difference, centralization, a centralized system is where you have a big bank, Goldman Sachs, and you have a couple other big banks around it. They have Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citibank, and then they trade value through a central hub, let's say the New York Stock Exchange. Okay, that's a fully decentralized system. A decentralized system is when you have a few centralized hubs, such as New York Stock Exchange, London Stock Exchange, et cetera, and you have many banks. And then those banks then deal with smaller guys, such as the mom and pops. That's better. It's somewhat centralized, but it's somewhat decentralized as well. And there's a sliding grade of centralization. Extreme centralization, getting less and less down to decentralized. Distributed system is where there is no central hubs at all. Everybody acts on their own. So everybody is their own bank, their own broker, their own insurance company, and they deal directly with each other. That is a system which, with the correct technology, is by far the most efficient because you get instant supply and demand, you get instant market feedback.
Right.
And a distributed system economic and technological nirvana.
Exactly. And that's what I said. That's what we're proponents of. We want to push the decentralized distributed model. I mean, I don't know if you've been on our Facebook group, but, you know, our banner says NBA Circle of Peers, distributed we stand. So it's like that whole model, like you said, is way more efficient when you have everyone kind of voting. And I think James also talked about this, too, in one of his talks, was that we need the 7 billion people on the planet to put in their input, you know, behind situations, you know, as opposed to only hearing from, you know, the 51% or whoever had the most money at the time to put out the largest marketing campaign. You know what I mean? That type of stuff. What's up?
To be absolutely honest, let's say you have about roughly 7 billion people on the planet. Out of that 7 billion, you probably only have about, say, 900 to 2 billion who are actually connected. Out of that 900 million to 2 billion, the ones who have the economic, technological, and social political power to really affect change, you're talking a few million tops, maybe 10, 40 million tops. So, you know, you have a centralized system as it stands. To truly decentralize the system, you have to get the majority of that system being connected, and you have to give them the ability to transact at the same level and efficiency as that top 0.01%. Now, using our current system is absolutely impossible because it's power and access that gives them the power and access. A fully distributed system such as Veritasium gives the exact same power to access to everybody. If you can touch the network, you can transact on it. You can transact in it at the same level as anybody else. You could trade 18 cents just as easy as you could trade $180 million.
Wow. Right. And I think that's the most, like you said, the efficiency of being able to provide that for everyone in the distributed network is the most important thing. Brother SU, go ahead.
I wanted to ask Reggie, first and foremost, just so that we can get a better comprehension or a basic comprehension, I should say, of Veritasium and UltraCoin. Is it like Bitcoin and blockchain where the Bitcoin is the fuel for the blockchain and the blockchain is the thing that, you know, is the ledger itself, which is allowing us to do these things in a decentralized manner, these transactions, these trustless transactions?
I tell you what, before I go on, I want to make sure you're all using the same meanings for the same vernacular.
Yes, sir.
Has the previous guest or is your crowd familiar with the terms blockchain, platform decentralized, or should I go over that quickly to make sure we're all talking the same thing?
I think that we should start from the root. Yes, sir.
Okay. So my system, Veritasium, is a overlay to write and read smart contracts on the Bitcoin blockchain. Before I go forward, we're going to identify each and every one of these concepts and terms. So Bitcoin is a technology that basically allows A to deal directly with B, and that's what it is. A lot of people consider it a digital currency. A digital currency is an application written on top of a Bitcoin platform, but it's one of many applications. Bitcoin is a platform. It is a protocol-based platform. Protocol is basically a set of instructions that tells you how to do things. Okay? A very, very powerful and popular protocol-based platform was popularized about 20 years ago, and that's IP, the Internet Protocol, which is the Internet. That protocol-based platform changed the lives of almost everybody who was born into it and preceding it, and is basically the backbone of business, communication, and information transfer today. It is my contention that the Bitcoin platform is at least as important as the Internet. You know, Bitcoin now is where the Internet was in 1993, 1994. And in 1993, 1994, a lot of people weren't familiar with the Internet, didn't know a lot about it, but it grew very, very quickly. And it became very, very powerful. Now, when we use the word blockchain, blockchain is the underlying technology, one of the primary underlying technologies behind Bitcoin. What the blockchain is a database, okay? And it's a database that's distributed amongst all of its users. The typical database is owned by one company or one person or one entity on a server or several servers, and it's controlled by that entity. The blockchain takes that database application and it spreads it among hundreds of thousands or millions of entities. And each entity that has a copy of the blockchain has a full copy of it, and those who are running software, computers and software, to maintain it, get to vote on the veracity of the transactions on the blockchain. If 51% of them say that transaction is valid, then it's considered valid, and it's stored in the blockchain for all time without being able to be broken. Okay? So that is one thing that makes the blockchain technology fantastic, a new invention. It's immutable. It's unbreachable. Right now, we have basically one extra hash of computing power behind the blockchain. That is, give or take, I'll go rough the math out, say 1,000 Googles. If Google could take all of its computing power and direct it to one single math problem, right, wow. Which it probably couldn't, but if it could, and then you could multiply that by roughly 1,000, you'd have the power of the blockchain. The blockchain is the most powerful computer network in existence. It's more powerful than Google, than the NSA, than KGBs, whatever they do, etc. So when you think of the blockchain, think of this massive database on this massive distributed computer, and think of Veritasium as an overlay on top of it that gives you a digital wallet that allows you to write and read smart contracts. So these smart contracts are basically social legal agreements that are between two or more people. They're written onto the blockchain and sent up to this large distributed computer from all over the world that can't be hacked, that can't be broken, that can't be faked, and that guarantee the terms of the contract will be executed as promised, just as long as 2 plus 2 continues to equal 4. And mathematically, 2 plus 2 always equals 4. Now, socially,
that's right.
And if certain people's, you know, ledger accounts, like Bear Stearns, 2 plus 2 equals 55. But, you know, once math comes and rears its ugly head, those companies go bust.
That's
so
right.
That is a quick synopsis of what the blockchain is and what Bitcoin is. Now, if you think of this platform and you think of the most popular app on it right now, which is digital currency, you can write many, many other apps. Do it as a tapestry that's really right now a blank canvas. And you have a couple of skilled painters, a good imagination, some good technical skills, and they just start painting. And this is where the Internet was in 1993. The most popular application was email back then, or FTP, file transfer protocol, where you just sent one file to another person, or email where you typed in the text in the little box, you sent it to another person. A lot of people thought, wow, this is fantastic. And they thought that was the extent of the Internet. And then you have a lot of entrepreneurs and, you know, smart people come and Google pops up, Google Voice, Facebook, YouTube, Salesforce.com, you know, all types of wonderful, fantastic things.
That's right. That's right. You know,
applies,
pardon me. I'll
finish up. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I wanted to say that is actually what it is that we're recommending with those that are, you know, studying with us this technology and those that are listening in now. It is about building applications on top of the Bitcoin, right? So that because, as you said, it's wide open at this point. It's all about imagination and your ability to understand, one, what you're working with, and two, you know, there's a lot of different problems that need solving, and you can absolutely use this technology for it. But please continue.
Yeah. So basically, real building applications on top of the Bitcoin platform, just like the early Googles are building applications on top of the internet platform. We were lucky to get patents in very early, and in doing that, we have the potential to stake a claim on a very, very wide swath of value. Think about, think in 1993, if someone would have successfully patented e-commerce. So every time someone did a transaction on the internet and made money, you had to cut him 1%. You know, not a bad start. Good work if you could get it, right? The coming up next after this is the ability to create new business models. The premise of the blockchain, as I see it, is the ability for total strangers to transact total safety without brokers, without third parties, without banks, without insurance companies, without medical providers, et cetera. If you're able to do that, then the entire business, hold for 1 second. Pardon me.
Are you going home? Yeah. You are listening to the House of the Moorish King. Go ahead.
Okay. So, and in doing that, the business models that hold sway right now are going to change significantly. And the primary reason they're going to change is because there's no need for most of those who stand as a gatekeeper in transaction processes. For instance, if you have a bank, and a bank makes its money from giving out loans, and it charges interest. Well, most banks do not have the capital to actually lend themselves. What they do is they have startup capital, which is called equity, and then they leverage that equity up by borrowing additional money, and then they go get a banking license. And then go on the business of taking an additional capital, which are checking accounts and savings accounts from savers. These are very low-risk investors that go and give their money to a bank. This is a very, very important concept because a lot of people feel that when they give money to the bank, they're giving their money to the bank for the bank to hold and safekeeping. That's not how it works. When you go and open up a checking account or a savings account, you put your money in, you're giving a bank a short-term loan that is unsecured. You know, and you're basically giving the bank, you're giving the bank your money, the bank is giving back an IOU. It is no longer your money. Now you simply have an unsecured loan with the promise of the bank to pay you back. Okay, the bank takes that money and then uses it to lend out to others at a much higher interest rate, and they profit off of the spread. That's very good business if you could do it, get it, and this is why Wall Street, you know, multi-trillion dollar a year business. Now, what the bank does is it takes money from the savers and it aggregates it, and then it lends it to risk takers and investors. You know, so it takes money from the many and gives it to the few. What happens if you have technology that can connect the savers with the risk takers directly? Exactly what does the bank need it for? Mm-hmm. And in connecting them directly, you can reduce the risk significantly because you have credit risk, you have counterparty risk, fail-safe, you have full transparency to the blockchain, et cetera. So not only do you disintermediate the bank, you take that middleman out, but you do it and increase the efficiency, the safety, the transparency, you know, and reduce the cost because you take the bank fees totally out. The concept, the economic concept behind this is, if let's suppose the bank charges 3% for mortgages, okay, or 2%, 3% for mortgages. But the bank is getting the money at 15 basis points because we have negative zero interest rates all around the world. So the bank is getting a fairly large spread. Okay, it could be considered, that spread could be considered rent seeking. Rent seeking is an economic term where you have an in-betweener that extracts compensation from a deal or transaction, but does not put back the requisite value. that's a fancy rare thing. At the easy rare thing, it is someone who gets paid without deserving.
Right.
So this platform, this software, this technology can now take rent seekers and eliminate them. So all those middlemen, all those third parties, you know, all those in-betweeners, all those rent seekers are now taken out of the picture. And don't confuse rent seeking with, you know, a landlord who says, you know, give me rent at the end of the month. You know, that's the business term. The economic term is different. Now, that does not mean all middlemen go the way of the dodo bird. The middleman truly adds value, then you're going to want him to be part of the deal because he adds value. But he and she must add value. And if they don't add value, then they go, the market gets rid of them because it's an unnecessary expense.
This absolutely, Reggie. Before you go further, I do want to throw two things out there so that you throw them in the mix of your further explanation. I was at the Bitcoin Expo in MIT just this past weekend, and two of the entities that were present, R3, they had a representative there, one of the presenters, and NASDAQ Link. I'm sure you're aware of both of those. Is that correct?
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind, tell us about that and where you think maybe there's some flaws or what have you, but definitely let's tie that into the conversation. I definitely want to hear your take on that as well.
Okay. R3 is a startup, a very well-connected startup, started by those who are prominent, well-connected in the banking industry. And basically, it's a startup that is creating a consortium of the more prominent banks and financial players in the industry. I think right now there's about 43 of them, and all the big names, you know, J.P. Morgan, RBS, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they are taking the blockchain technology, Bitcoin technology, but because Bitcoin has a bad mark to it, they call it blockchain. But you can't have a blockchain without the Bitcoin technology as it stands. So they take the blockchain technology, and they are getting the banks to cooperate on using it for solving XYZ business case scenarios or improving XYZ business cases. That's what R3 does. NASDAQ Link is doing the same thing, taking the Bitcoin technology, the blockchain technology, and using it to create faster settlement. And if I'm not mistaken, the NASDAQ Link is working on their private pre-IPO share trading. These are good things. What they're doing is they're increasing the efficiency of their back office technology. This is good. But if you remember when I first started discussing this in an earlier part of the show, you have good technologies and then you have truly disruptive technologies. These technologies are good. They're taking an engine, they're tuning it up, and they're adding a turbocharger to it. So now this Mustang, this six-cylinder Mustang, goes much faster. You know, now you have a twin turbocharged V6. You know, it can
perfect
really
analogy.
Run. Okay? But Real Veritasium is building a transporter. You're going Star Trek. So as you're turbocharging, that Mustang, we're looking on eliminating the need for cars in general. So you have R3 with a consortium of banks that are looking for them to trade on a centralized basis more efficiently, because they're trading amongst each other, but they still have their millions of customers that have to go to the bank for services. Same thing with the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. And then you have the Veritasium platform, which empowers all the individual customers of those banks and those exchanges to deal directly with each other. Okay? A total sea change in the way things are done. The ability to deal directly with each other without having to rely on banks, on exchanges, on R3s, on NASDAQ links, is called autonomy. Autonomy is the ability to act on your own, of your own volition, on your own will. The antithesis, or the opposite of autonomy, is heteronomy. Heteronomy is when you have to rely on a centralized authority in order to proceed. Right now, the legacy system is a heteronomous system. What I'm looking to bring to the forefront is true autonomy. I hope I answered that fully. It's a lot of words, but you know, if you think about them, it hits pretty hard.
I'm definitely mind blown right now. I'm very much so aware of what's going on, you know, and what's forming in the Bitcoin ecosystem. And as I've like even promoted the show. I was, you know, I even referenced, you know, the concept of like Hercules, because this thing that you're attempting to do, this work, you know, you're going up against tremendous odds. Would you agree?
I'm going up against tremendous forces, and you know, they're very well financed. You know, we're bootstrapped, you know, pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. But you have, number one, you have truly creative and inventive talent. You have a lot of drive, and you know, we have some very early thinking. You know, no matter how much money you have, you know, the guys that come with ideas first and execute properly have an asset. You know, our other patent applications are an asset. Our team is an asset. You know, very few of the guys working in these entities, and not downplaying at all, these are all very smart, capable people and very accomplished, and not to mention many of them quite wealthy, but they simply don't have the diversity of experience that some of our teammates have. And they're not nearly as hungry. You know, I have to make this work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's powerful. You know, honestly, I think that, you know, you are absolutely one of our role models in regards to pioneering this space. You were one of the very first people that I came across when I was attempting to even study and understand what is Bitcoin, what is the blockchain, what are the financial implications. Like, I really didn't have a clue. And even at that point, you were already creating a platform. You were already creating a coin. So I definitely tip my hat to you, and I want you to know that we're definitely in support. I'd like for you to really come back, Reggie, if at all possible. I'd like for our listeners to become very familiar with you, and maybe we even begin to onboard people into this process, because I feel there's liberation there, you know?
I would definitely appreciate it. We're looking to have our next milestone completed by the end of this month, and that would be web pages that actually hold assets. So you have an actual web page that holds your assets on the web page. Assets that's an actual coin and money. This is the first. And these assets are smart assets. They're smart contracts. So not only does it hold the assets, you can program the assets to act like Goldman Sachs, act like J.P. Morgan, and do the full practically disguised with it. And we need users. And we need users who are interested, and it's best to have users who are not already from the legacy system, because that automatically constrains their thought processes. You know, they have tunnel vision. People who are new to it, we give them these tools, and they create totally new ways of doing business. Now, think about the music artist who can now sell his music directly. The music is the money, and the money is the music. So he can program the music XYZ money is now contributed to his wallet.
Absolutely. With that being said, I want to pass the mic to my co-host, Free. Did you have any other closing questions, comments?
No, not really. I mean, the brother has to get back to his family, so, you know, let's close it out with him, and I think me and you can rap a little bit more, and then Reggie, you know, try to promote our YouTube channel and everything to your circle. We'll do likewise thing, so we grow this network even further, you know what I mean? Like you said, there's liberation in this whole situation, so let's promote each other as much as we can. And I bid you well, brother. Peace.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you again, Reggie, for joining us. I really appreciate you coming online.
Okay.
We hope to have you back so that, again, we can get more familiar with Veritasium.
Will do. Anytime. Just give me a call.
All right, brother. Take care.
Okay.
Powerful build.
Powerful build.
Indeed, indeed. So, as the listeners, you know, got to hear for the last hour and a half, you know, a lot of powerful information brought to you by the House of the Moorish King, you know what I mean? This is the type of content that we're going to be striving for to continue to keep giving you, you know what I mean? With a reoccurring guest that you'll be able to speak with, you know, in the future, as of right now, like you said, we have to keep it to certain, you know, guidelines to make sure that they can get all their information out, because it's so much and it's so powerful, you know what I mean? And I'm loving it, you know what I mean? This is what we've been wanting to do, bro, you know what I mean? Like, this is it.
Absolutely. I'll say this. I think that we're presenting something that's fresh to the community, that's new to the community. I think that the community is really going to grow. There's no way, you know what I'm saying, after listening to a podcast like this and associating yourself with, quote unquote, the conscious community, that the dialogue remains the same, or at least remains in that same box. You feel me on that?
Yeah, it has to expand the way, you know, everyone's consciousness has to expand every day. I mean, we have to evolve, man, or else we're going to die. You know what I mean? And this decentralized, distributed model is one of our ways of evolution. I wouldn't say it's our end all to be all. Like, don't think that we, you know, this is like a religion or anything like that. We just see the efficiency in this, and we see the problem that exists in our society and in our economy, and these are the tools to help us fix it. Because it's not perfect. Like James said, this system is not perfect in any way, shape, or form yet. You know what I mean? It still has a long way to go. It's like internet back in the AOL days. You know what I mean? So
I'm glad that he said it. That's what I was telling you.
Keep it real,
man. Like, he's the only one of all the people talking about it. You have insiders and outsiders, right? The outsiders are hoping that it don't work. Right, because they ain't invest no time into like understanding or nothing like that. They probably actually invested in the opposite. So, you know, for this to collapse on itself, you know, that's actually the better bet, right? So now if the thing actually works, though, like, it's a problem, you know, for those folks. And
well, that's
now
why they
the
got
insiders,
their R3.
Now,
that's why they now. Yeah, they got their R3 committee in case it does work and everyone's using the blockchain in the world. They have a hand in it already. You know what I mean?
Bruh,
that's what I see with that
bruh,
whole R3.
You heard what Reggie said? He said it's like putting in the souped up engine, right? You drop your engine, put the soup one in there, and you know what I'm saying? You got a whole different mobile, right? It's a whole other situation going on.
Right.
So like he said, he's absolutely correct, man. I was sitting there listening to those folks. And yeah, you got like 40-some-odd banks,
like
the big wigs, right? They figuring out how they're going to implement this technology. And based upon their experiments, they've been successful. They're talking about adding more banks into groups so they could do more sophisticated type of things with the blockchain. Right?
Indeed.
Mainly financial transactions, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, today we had a post in the NBA Circle of Peers talking about the banks and them and with their whole blockchain thing. And, you know, with the centralized model, they're trying to decentralize as much as possible, but still keep it in that central manner. And like James said, that is happening on the mining scale as well, because you have certain people and certain mining firms that were way ahead of the curve when Bitcoin was, you know, 25 cents a Bitcoin. You know what I mean? And now they got billions or millions worth of Bitcoin now. But the beauty of it is that we can build applications on top of it like we've been talking about all night. And that is where the real, you know, magic happens, is the new applications that are built on top of it so that it can take away that centralized mining, monopoly situation.
So here's what's wild about James. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is why we want to have James on the show, because he's our resident contrarian, right?
Shake it up.
Yeah,
it has,
man,
to happen.
So,
it has
so,
to be there. You know, Earth is not it, authentic. You know what I mean?
That's right. Nah,
one-sided.
So you already heard him, though. His thing wasn't like, you know, the ones that have any real power in terms of mining are those that are actually making finance off of it, right? Economy of scale, right? If you're not generating a profit through mining, then your mining is of lesser value. I'm not going to say he's saying it's useless, but you know what I'm saying? He's definitely saying that it's of lesser consequence, right? At least for the miner,
right? Well, if nothing right. else. And we don't want to do. I know James isn't with nodes like making too much of an impact, but I still support the fact that everyone should still be opening up nodes as much as possible just to get yourself familiar with the concept of having a node, which is your whole voting system, which is your whole database, which you can, you know, verify the ledger as well. Just people getting used to verifying ledgers themselves as opposed to letting the central authority do it. You know what I mean?
I'm going to go a step further. I'm going to say it's more than just nodes. Why not miners too? Like the 21 Bitcoin computer is a miner, and James is absolutely correct. That's not something that you buy in hopes that you're going to turn a profit mining. You're going to make like less than $3 a month through mining. But here's the deal, right? Here's the deal. So you got the blockchain, you got Bitcoin. We got to really like make this like comprehensible. You know what I'm saying? So let's say we talk about one of these little, what do they call them? Peter Piper Pizza, right? They got the little gaming area, right? The arcade section, right? When you go in there, you take your dollars, but you got to buy the token so that you could play the games. So it's like the same
tokenization.
But again, even for you to participate, you actually have to have the token. It's just like in life, right? Like if you don't have no money, you can't play. You see what I'm saying? So it's very, very important that the individual understand what it is that we're talking about. And like I said, so with the Bitcoin in particular or the blockchain in particular, I should say it like this. You can't participate on the blockchain unless you got Bitcoin. Right? You can't participate. So maybe this is what James is talking about, but what we're talking about as well when we talk about the app development, it only requires a small amount. Like Free, you can probably attest to this, you know, having some experience with it. Namecoin. When you got your Namecoin, what you were literally doing was like destroying the coin so that you could actually have the website. So again, it goes back into the concept of you need the token to play.
No, I mean, I think we've nailed it on the head, bro. I think like our audience specifically, but this was good for anyone who just tuned in for the first time tonight. I think it hit them really well too. You know what I mean? Like it covered the basics, the beginning, and it also went to the advanced concepts as well. You know what I mean? So I think, you know, we did it, bro. This is it. Can't wait till next week. You know what I mean? We got a repeat guest or we got a new guest?
Let's take a look. We have, for our next episode, Wesley Days, a new guest. I think everybody's going to be surprised with Brother Wesley. Actually, it was a surprise to meet him. I met him at the Bitcoin Expo as well. This brother is definitely, he's going to be special. I think everybody's going to enjoy this next guest as well. Less technical, I should say that up front. The brother's not so technically savvy. In fact, you know what I'm saying, he's a newcomer to the technology. However, I did meet him at the Bitcoin Expo, so with that being said, he does have an awareness, but he's not necessarily, you know, engaged in that per se, but has something to contribute, for sure.
Right, like that's exactly, that keeps everything well-rounded so you guys can see how people are dealing with it when they first get in, and then, you know, vets in the industry like James and like Reggie and like Anari, you know what I mean? And then you got people like Harry Rosenberg, you know what I'm saying, who are also coming in to it recently as well. So a lot of different looks that we got coming in here to keep it well-rounded for y'all.
That's right. Yeah, like you said, man, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up, close up. You've been listening to the Optimal Morris King. I'm your host, Eshie Miller L.
And I'm my brother, Free L Bay.
Yeah.
So, we also got the mixtape. Don't forget about it, y'all. The Decentralized Minds mixtape. It's an artist consortium, so we're trying to decentralize the music game as well. You know what I mean? So submit your tracks to djlilluminator@gmail.com. If you want to be on one of the mixtapes, we're paying you guys royalties in Bitcoin. All right? So check that out.
Peace.
Peace.